Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Co-host today, myself, Paul Wearson, and Dennis Hart. Good morning, Dennis.
Paul, good to see you again. You look bright and sassy today. At least you're sassy.
Well, you know, my makeup artist started at 4 a.m., and now we're ready.
Almost. Well, so am I. All right. Good to be with you.
And now, Dennis Hart with the news.
Let's begin with a look back at the Boone News Republican, which reports about two meetings held at Boone High School last week involving the Heart of Iowa Regional Transit Agency. The meetings were designed to introduce patrons to HRTA's new schedule app. It's called Amble. It is a pilot program in Boone for school-aged riders. Amble is a free smartphone app, and it gives riders access to manage their transportation needs, including scheduling or canceling rides, viewing upcoming trips, and seeing previous trips. HRTA, which is a rural transit agency, provides public transportation to seven counties, including Boone and Story. The News Republican also has word that a Boone man was arrested last week after authorities said he sexually abused a 12-year-old girl for more than a year. If he's convicted, 32-year-old Roger Christopher McGee could face up to 42 years in prison. News Republican also reports that Boone County has been recertified as a storm-ready county. Getting that certification means, among other things, the county has numerous ways to receive and disseminate weather information. Also in the News Republican, word that the Boone County Fair Board is accepting applications for the board. Those applications are due by September 4th. In the Nevada Journal, an absolutely heartbreaking story, a compelling story, about a 10-year-old girl who would have started the sixth grade this fall at Nevada Middle School. But 10-year-old Allison Richeson gave up on life, and she took her own life. This is a story full of heartache. It's difficult to read, and it is an important read from last week's Nevada Journal and from last Saturday's Ames Tribune. Also in the Journal, word that a big change is coming to the Harmony Clothing Closet in Nevada. That's a place where families can find free clothing and where community members can donate clothing that's in good condition. Starting next month, Harmony Clothing will no longer be open on Saturday mornings because there simply aren't enough volunteers available on Saturdays. So starting next month, Harmony Clothing will be open Mondays and Thursdays from 4:30 to 7 p.m. and Wednesday mornings from 9 to 11. The Journal also has a delightful story about three girls from Ames who set up a lemonade stand in Nevada this past summer, earned more than $100, and then donated it to the Story County Animal Shelter. But they were not done yet. The girls set up a second lemonade stand, raised a bit more than $200, and they donated that to the Nevada Public Safety Department, which includes firefighters, police officers, and emergency medical providers. Bravo to those three girls. In the Story City Herald, word that the State Department of Natural Resources and the Story County Conservation Board plan to start drawing down Hickory Grove Lake near Colo this week, part of a continuing lake restoration effort to improve water quality and enhance accessibility and recreational opportunities. Also in the Herald, word that Roland Story Ag Education students and FFA members have again undertaken running a community garden. All the produce is going to be donated to the Loaves and Fishes Food Pantry in Story City and to Food at First in Ames. The garden is about 3 acres in size with a wide variety of vegetables planted. Last year, nearly 12,000 pounds of produce were grown in that garden and donated to area food pantries. The Herald also reports that a well-known restaurant in Story City, it's under new ownership. It's the McDonald's fast food restaurant, which has been sold to Kevin O'Brien and the O'Brien Organization. And that's not the only McDonald's that's changed hands. The two in Ames have also been sold, as well as one in Nevada, one in Boone, and one in Carroll. Also in the Herald, word that the Roland Farmers Market is going to be held tomorrow, Thursday, from 5 to 7 on Main Street. The market will be held on Thursdays for the rest of the season. And the Roland Public Library is going to be there as well, with all kinds of activities for young children. One more note from the Herald, word about the upcoming 24th Annual Senior Variety Show that is set to take place, no, not in Story City, but right here in Ames. The theme of this year's show is simply stellar, that's what they call it, and it will be performed Friday night, August 17th, and Sunday afternoon, the 18th, at the Ames City Auditorium downtown. And, of course, what makes this show unique is that it's performed by adults who are at least 60 years old. In the Tri-County Times, a story about the annual Pushing Our Pedals for Charlie bike ride that took place Saturday on the High Trestle Trail. Charlie is a 5-year-old girl who has cystic fibrosis. For several years now, a bike ride has been held in her name. The money that's raised goes to fund research for cystic fibrosis, which is a genetic disorder that can damage the lungs and digestive system. Good for those folks on that bike ride. And that, Paul's our weekly summary of news from the pages of the Boone News Republican, the Nevada Journal, the Story City Herald, and the Tri-County Times. Of course, Those papers are going to have a lot more news when their print editions come out this week. And a reminder that I'll be back here on Friday with a look at news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. How about those girls in Nevada who raised all that money?
Isn't that wonderful?
That is a great story.
You know, it's terrific because, number one, they get the publicity, but and they get an opportunity to really be visible in the community. But number two, it fosters a volunteer spirit that I hope they have for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful story. Their grandmother lives in Nevada. That's why they set up the stand there. So $100 for the animal shelter, $200 for EMS. That is just wonderful and good for those girls.
Well, I've noticed that most of your news is good news. So
yes.
When we talk about the surrounding community, it must be paradise to live in Story County.
Well, right? You know, it must be. But, you know, there are things that happen. And as you know, a couple of weeks ago, we had some severe tornadoes in three areas around us here, in Bondurant, in Pella, and in Marshalltown. And there are new developments in all of those towns, but I want to talk about Marshalltown, what's happened there. Hit by that bad tornado on July 19th, we got some new figures just in the last couple of days about the damage there. 89 homes destroyed, 525 homes with major damage, 94 with minor damage. 7 businesses destroyed, 4 businesses with major damage, 9 had minor damage. Those are far more than we thought initially. Good news in the past week, some major donations have been announced there. JBS, which employs 2,300 people in Marshalltown, in that pork facility, donating $1 million, to relief efforts. And Lennox is donating $500,000. So a lot going on in Marshalltown. And joining us on the line right now, we are pleased to have reporter Adam Sauters of the Marshalltown Times-Republican newspaper. Adam, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
You were there when that tornado hit. Please describe what happened the day that tornado hit in Marshalltown from your perspective.
Well, I have a much safer and probably less scary perspective than a lot of the folks who actually live in Marshalltown. I'm from the Community Estate Center, which is just outside of Marshalltown. And just down the road, down Highway 30 from Marshalltown. And so I was actually, by happenstance, I was able to take a few hours off early that morning, or that afternoon, sorry. And I had gone home, was working on some important schoolwork that night. And, of course, the same storm that passed over Marshalltown passed over State Center, and it sent our sirens off a few times. So, you know, just like I normally do, living in Iowa and being used to tornado warnings about this time, I picked my dog up and we went to the basement a few times. And, you know, I was never worried about anything happening in the State Center or Marshalltown for that matter. So, you know, obviously nothing happened here in State Center. So I go back up and I decided, you know, maybe there's a story here, maybe, you know, how the county and other emergency responders mobilized just in case of a tornado. Of course, this was, as it turned out, wishful thinking on my part. So I called the emergency management coordinator here. Her name is Kim Elder. She also lives in State Center, and she happened to be just north of town looking at the storm that would produce that tornado that, of course, devastated Marshalltown a few weeks ago. She was looking at it from our perspective from the west. And from there, we did not see the funnel cloud. Some folks who were closer obviously did see it, but we were unable to because of rain, because of the clouds. And she kind of explained all the in-depth weather stuff to me that I'm not as familiar with. But so we watched the storm for a little bit, and I remember her commenting that this is maybe that storm from our perspective. She was looking at things like the updraft and the downdraft and other factors. And she said, this looks like about a perfect storm for a tornado. And of course, even that didn't really, you know, if I suppose after years of living here and never dealing with tornado damage, I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, well, hopefully that doesn't happen, but I wasn't particularly worried about it. So, she was nice enough to give me a short ride along as we, stayed well outside of the storm danger area, but still followed it a little bit. And then her radio, I noticed, started really going off, and she was connected to all of the county officials or county police and city police and things like that, and they were starting to talk about a dangerous situation of some kind. And she dropped me back off of my car. As soon as I got there, I decided it's probably best if I get back into town. So I drove as quickly as I safely could back to Marshalltown. And based on that, I probably left just outside State Center. I probably left, so quarter after four, maybe a little before that. Of course, the tornado hit a little about 4:40 p.m. And so sometime in the time that it took me to get from State Center to Marshalltown, I think is when that tornado was actually tearing through the north side of town there.
And what did you find when you got into Marshalltown? What did you see?
Well, the first thing I noticed, of course, it was sort of a slow buildup. So I'd see, you know, a branch here or a piece of debris from a house there. Nothing like, you know, what you would see was straight line wind damage. Nothing that indicated a catastrophe. But as I got further into town, so I'm driving on Main Street here from outside of town to kind of into the downtown area, I got cut off eventually because a giant tree had fallen across the road. And I noticed, probably the first thing I noticed was all of the traffic. There were a lot of people out. And I don't know if they were just trying to get home from work, whether they were trying to get out of the area because they saw all the damage and were going to try and find another place to stay that night. Or if they were, you know, honestly, I think there were a lot of people out just, you know, looking at the damage because it was such a novelty and kind of a, you know, just kind of a weird novelty to look at that kind of destruction, I guess. So that was the first thing I noticed was small amounts of debris that built up into basically trees and large chunks of houses gone. And this is on the west side. This is a lot of the destruction occurred on the northeast side. So this isn't even, you know, probably the worst hit part of town based on what we know now. But I really at that point had no bearing. I didn't know how many people, I didn't know if people had died. I didn't know what was going on. I did know I had to get back to the TR to begin reporting because I knew there was definitely going to be stories.
The TR being the Times Republican newspaper.
The TR being the Times Republican, that's what we call it around here.
Right. So what was it like in those neighborhoods in downtown?
Well, in the downtown, so it was a little bit hard because I had to find, of course, an alternate route to get to work. And a drive that took me 1 minute during normal conditions took me probably 45 minutes under these conditions between the traffic and the debris blocking roads. So I eventually kind of stair-stepped my way back to the downtown area. It was bad. It was just... I commented that it looked like a bomb had went off in the downtown. I thought maybe at that time I was being a bit dramatic, but, you know, pieces of buildings were gone. Glass was all over the streets. Brick was all over the streets. So it was like, it was unlike anything I personally had ever seen. And, so the destruction in the downtown area was significant. Of course, one of the first things I noticed when I pulled into my parking lot, our courthouse, which is one of our historic buildings, and of course one of the more iconic buildings in town, had the top just off. Like the very top spire was just gone, and that's probably when it hit me that this was a big deal, this storm.
How were the people downtown, the people you saw, Marshalltown residents, in the immediate wake of this, how were they reacting? What were they doing?
It wasn't panic that I saw. It was, as far as just the residents that were out and about, they were literally just out and about. They looked like, you know, it was a lot of people on the Main Street area, which is kind of our downtown, one of our main streets through town. And, you know, they were out in their T-shirts and shorts, and some of them were holding hands and walking down the street because the sidewalk was, of course, had rubble. But it looked like, you know, and they were kind of looking at the damage and sort of, you know, of course, a lot of people were taking pictures with their cell phones and things like that. But I wouldn't describe it as panic. It was more maybe shock would be a better word than panic to describe what I saw from folks. You know, I don't recall anyone like crying or being overly emotional, not there at Main Street anyway. And then the business owners too, you know, one of the first people, I think actually the first person I talked to was Matt Gerstant, who owns Black Tire Bike Company, which is right next door to the TR. So it was the closest. I just went right over to him as I worked down Main Street. And he wasn't, you know, obviously he was unhappy that the front of his business, you know, had been torn up pretty well, and it was missing glass out of the front window, and it was significant damage, but he was optimistic. And that's what I met as I talked to a few other folks who own businesses as I moved down Main Street, who has experienced similar damage. But it was a kind of a surreal scene, because you had all of this destruction, yet, you know, you would expect a lot of people to be more panicky and more you'd expect more energy, and there just wasn't that from the residents. I would say they were just kind of in shock, as was the TR staff, but we knew we had a job to do, so we did it.
And you got out a major edition the next morning talking about this tornado, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. That was quite a bit of last minute planning. And I credit my publisher, Abigail Pelzer, and my editor, Emily Barsky, for kind of formulating that plan and figuring out how the heck we were going to get a paper out that night. Newspaper, our printing press was damaged, and our power was out. And, in the building, and of course that means we can't get a paper out, and our building did experience some damage. So we were meeting actually on the front steps of the TR, not inside the building at all. And they formulated this plan there. You know, Abigail told all of the reporters and Emily, you guys need to go out and get what stories you can. And we got our gear together, and we went out and did it, and talked to people and got photos, of what we were, basically just what we were seeing. And then after we collected all of that, I was lucky enough that of course, as I mentioned earlier, I live in the State Center. So after picking a very strange route through town to get back to the highway, I came back to State Center once I had all my stories and photos, and I got on my laptop here at home. I was lucky enough to have internet connection, which basically most of that area of Marshalltown couldn't say at that time. And I was able to get my stories in that way. Meanwhile, my editor and my publisher went over to Tama, to the Tama newspaper, whose printing press was luckily functional, and they took the information that me and my colleague Sarah Jordan-Heinz and Mike Donahue, we all sent in our stories and our photos, and they were able to throw it all together. We had a 10:30 deadline, and we were, you know, basically, because we were working so hard that night to get all those all those stories in, it was a lot of work to do very quickly, but we did it.
Did it cross your mind that this is a souvenir edition of the paper? The one you put together at that moment is probably going to be kept by everybody in town, and eventually will be a major document in any historical society display too. So it wasn't just your average edition, was it?
No, it wasn't. And I kind of came to that realization after that night. One thing I love about journalism, I certainly do not like having to have, you know, covering destruction and things like that, terrible things that happen to people. But there is an adrenaline rush, and you get to focus 100% on your job and doing a good job and writing and getting it all in on time and getting good photos when bad things do happen. And I was just so, personally, I was just so focused on getting stuff in on time and making it good and making sure my information was good, that I wasn't thinking about, you know, this is going to be a special edition. I was just thinking about this edition needs to happen.
And it happened in a way that I'm hoping that you're proud of, and that this will be. I collect important newspaper editions. I have a newspaper that announces Pearl Harbor and the end of the war, and they're valuable to me because everything is a right now account and a sort of a snapshot of that actual moment in history. Now, what's it like driving around Marshalltown today?
Well, it's a tale of two cities a little bit, because you drive around. We, of course, in Marshalltown, we have our Main Street area, our downtown area in the north, and that there's a lot of small businesses there. And of course, we have our industrial sector, our JBS in Lenox, who you mentioned with their donations to the relief efforts here in the city. That is the big kind of business and downtown area on the north side of town. On the south side of town, we've got Center Street, which includes some of our largest retail businesses, and it's kind of another main, for lack of a better term, kind of our other main drag through town, if you want to think about it like that. You go to the Center Street, the south side main drag, it, you know, you wouldn't think Marshalltown experienced any kind of a disaster necessarily. You see insurance, you know, like I think State Farm is set up in a parking lot on the south side of town for folks who need insurance, you know, information from them. But other than small things like that, you really, it's strange. And then you get into the north side of town, particularly the north, you know, the northwest side of town and the northeast side of town. And it's just, it's still, there are trees without tops on. There are tons of roofs with tarps on them. People, constantly out, whoever can, whoever doesn't have work that day, whoever's around is helping move debris. It's like two separate entities almost. Of course, Marshalltown is very unified in this recovery effort. People all over the city have been affected, even though it only hit a part of town. And recovery efforts similarly are unified. So I don't want to make it out like Southside isn't dealing with any of this. Of course they are, but just physically, the difference between those two sides of town is striking.
Adam, we have about 1 or 2 minutes left. Just briefly summarize for us the sense of the community right now. I think you're getting to it. Is there a sense of optimism that the community is on the rebound and will come back from this?
Yes, and that's been the case, I would say, since day one, maybe even before that, after the tornado hit. We have a, as a city, this Marshalltown Strong idea came about very quickly after the tornado. And it's, you see it on T-shirts, you see it on people's social media posts. I think there are yard signs maybe with it. So this idea of Marshalltown Strong, I would say, if you want to find one phrase or word that encompasses the entire attitude of the city after this incident, it would be Marshalltown Strong. People have just come together. People are offering food to one another. Neighbors are helping neighbors. You expect this from a small town in Iowa, but it's still heartwarming to see that type of thing.
Well, I have a personal question. Every time I go to Marshalltown, my first stop is Taylor's Made Right. And I have to ask you, is that okay? Is it still there?
Yes, it's still there, and my understanding is that it is still running. I see people. Taylor's is also a favorite of mine, I would say. And I always get a burger with mustard and pickles on it, two of them.
And they're wonderful malts. Oh, yes.
Yes, the malts for sure. But yes, they are, to answer your question, yes, they're operational and people are still going into Taylor's.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think I remember from news reports that they were furnishing a lot of food for people.
They were.
Right, in the initial outcome after the tornado. So I'm not surprised that the Taylor folks were really involved in the instant response in a way that people were tangibly benefiting from those wonderful sandwiches.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us. The next time I get over to Marshalltown, and I was there a couple of weeks ago after this tornado, I owe you a malt and a burger at Taylor's. How's that?
Yes.
That sounds good.
Thank you. Reporter Adam Sauters with an outstanding personal recollection from the Marshalltown Times Republican newspaper about what happened in Marshalltown that day, Paul, and what's happened since then. And it sounds as if the community's on the rebound.
Well, it was a great story, and you could tell from his own personal experience how this sort of unwrapped itself and looked like something minor until you drove into town, and then the utter shock of seeing the total destruction that was part of that part of the city experienced, and how he was professional and right away worked on the paper and got out the edition.
And I like the idea that there are signs out there now saying Marshalltown Strong.
Yes.
Good for them.
Yep, it's a blessing. Every time there's a major catastrophe, there's a heartening human response.
Yep. And we'll be right back.
I've never had a way with women, but the hills of Iowa make me wish that I could. And I've never found a way to say I love you, but if the chance came by, oh, I would. But way back where I come from, we never mean to bother. We don't like to make our passions other people's concern. And we walk in the world of safe people, and at night we walk into our houses and burn. I love, I love, I love, I love, I love, I love, I love. How I long to fall just a little bit, to dance out of the lights and stray from the light. But I fear that to fall in love with you is to fall from a great and gruesome height. So you know I asked a friend about...
That was Iowa by Dar Williams. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 on your dial, both Story City, Ames, and surrounding area. And as a regular feature here, we now have Leanne Harder, County Outreach and Special Projects Manager at Story County. Leanne's here to give us an update. Leanne, good morning, and how are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. I'm going to start out really quick with some news from Veterans Affairs, a couple upcoming events. The first one is next week. It's an event hosted by Iowa State Extension, and it will be held at the Extension Office in Nevada, which is at 220 H Avenue. You can register by calling 382-6551 by this Friday, August 10th. It's called Story County Military and Extension Conversations. I have conservation later coming on. But it's an opportunity to build relationships between those military in Iowa and Iowa State Extension and Outreach. So, again, if you want to register, and I think registration is required, contact Iowa State Extension at 382-6551. And then a couple months ahead of time, but we want to start getting the word out, the Supermarket of Veterans Benefits is scheduled for November 13th. This has been a very, very popular event. It runs from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. We want to get the word out now, though, because it's at a new location. It is going to be held at the Plex, which is on George Washington Carver Avenue, northwest of Ames, so 5501 G.W. Carver Avenue. It used to be held at the Moose Lodge on 190th, but we're moving location because it is such a popular event. So, again, I'll say that again in September and probably October, maybe even November, too. But it'll be 11-13, November 13th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And then kind of switching gears to conservation, since I said that a couple minutes ago. Story County Conservation did start the partial drawdown of the Hickory Grove Lake. That's our probably most popular park in Story County. It did start on Monday, and they're anticipating that we'll lower 1 foot per day until they're 10 feet below full pool. This is part of an overall restoration plan to really improve the water quality and quantity of that whole facility. What they're trying to do right now is get that level to a level, get the water to a level that they can do in a full archaeological survey before the actual in-lake construction begins.
Now, how long is that lake going to be drawn down?
That lake will be going down. Great question. They might not pump the rest of the lake until next spring, but they're going to keep a lake depth at the main channel of 32 feet so that there's still some boating and angler that can take place. The full project is at about 90% design right now. They'll be enlarging the island and creating a bridge to the island, which will be a really nice amenity. Again, the main project goals are improving boating and fishing access, increasing aesthetic values and recreational opportunities, and then just really increasing awareness of our water quality issues and watershed management that we deal with in Iowa and central Iowa. But the whole project is said to be concluded by 2020. So it'll be a couple years away before we see everything up and going and the relaxed regulations, which I love saying that, on the anglers is still in effect. So I don't want to say it's a free-for-all, but those that enjoy fishing have a lot of opportunity out there at Hickory Grove right
now.
So
it's going to be drawn down next summer. I mean, all next summer.
All next summer it will be. I don't know. They'll start the lake restoration and the rebuilding and everything next summer. Maybe even this winter, too, if they have a chance again, do some shoreline work. They are constantly putting updates on the Green Print blog on Story County Conservation's page, which I'll conclude with at the end where the county's website is. So you can stay up to date there, and the conservation will have me pass along updates here, too. It's a really exciting project. The funding is coming from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and it's a wonderful opportunity and partnership for the folks of Story County. Time, y'all. Water quality is a top priority for Story County. We'll have our consultants come down from Minnesota next week and present our watershed assessments to the Board of Supervisors next Tuesday. We are the only county in Iowa to look comprehensively at all of our watersheds on a certain level that's smaller than just Squaw Creek level. We're digging and getting our homework done. Really, really switching gears. I had to do the obligatory property tax reminder coming up September 1st.
Oh, no, I heard that was happening.
Yeah. It just seems like I just did the March one, too. But those of you that pay your property taxes at the treasurer's office, make sure you get in between now and September 30th. Property taxes are due. And then lastly, I do want to share that we continue to have openings for boards and commissions. Applications are available on our website. They will be due by October 5th, but we have openings for Asset, the Board of Adjustment, Board of Health, Condemnation Commission, the Conservation Board, Planning and Zoning Commission, and then Veterans Affairs. And then we have a kind of a really interesting dialogue and opportunity that we're just starting to delve into right now. We've been doing, as a county, some continuity of planning, continuity of government. We call it COOP-COG, which is kind of fun to say. What our COOP-COG is really the opportunity for Story County to plan ahead. If we were to face something like that, how do we make sure the citizens can still access the level of service that they need and understanding that we have some limitations? And this past Monday, Marty Chitty, who's one of our supervisors, and Keith Morgan, our emergency management coordinator, went over to our neighbors next door in Marshall County. They're starting a really interesting dialogue on how we can learn from what they're dealing with, and then we can use some of our resources to assist them. So we can basically share our plans with them and then massage our plans as needed based on their lessons learned. So it's a great opportunity, and just stay tuned because we'll want some input. What are the expectations of the public on what kind of levels of services you expect and so forth? Story County's website is at storycountyiowa.gov. I may be reached via email at lharter@storycountyiowa.gov. And my phone number is 515-382-7247.
Let me toss a quick question out since I don't know anything about this. The watershed assessments you talked about,
mm-hmm.
There are many things I don't know things about, including that. What does that mean? You're going to assess watersheds, and then what? What happens?
That's a great question. We don't know what happens next yet because we had to first do our homework and do the watershed assessments and figure out what the health was of our current watersheds. We had an idea. There's some great tools that we're putting on our website that people can go out and see based on specific watersheds, what type of practices on land may be helpful to help improve the water quality and quantity in that specific watersheds. The next steps to get to your question will be coming. We'll be defining those. Once the Board of Supervisors receives the report and fully understands the implications, Then we'll start budgeting for any necessary improvements that Story County can do, start identifying the public-private partnerships, start looking for additional resources within the agricultural community, business community, whatever it may be. And I can't remember who you say this, but it may have been former Supervisor Paul, too, before he passed away. You know, it's you take an elephant one bite at a time. That's why. You chew on an elephant one bite at a time. And, you know, we didn't get into this situation overnight, and it's not just specific to Story County. Water quality throughout Central Iowa, Iowa Midwest, is really a concern, and we want to take a lead and start to address it. But
well, I think I heard you say that we really are really ahead of many counties in Iowa on this watershed study. So Story County can be proud that they're in the forefront of looking at this issue and taking action. So I think we can be proud of what we're doing in Story County.
Yeah, it's been a great project that I've been really pleased to be able to work on. And, you know, I'm not a scientist, or especially a soil scientist by education, but I am an Iowan. I'm a Central Iowan. I'm very proud of our heritage, agricultural heritage, and and know that we're all in this together.
Well, I'm a Central Iowan who drinks water.
I have a spouse that's in the water industry too. So
is
I
that
have
right?
a yeah. I did forget one thing I want to mention.
Well, there's a blood drive.
There is a blood drive coming up on next week. I cannot believe it's already the middle of August almost. But next Thursday, August 16th, here in Ames at the Human Services Center, Story County is partnering with the Red Cross for a 2-day blood drive. Day one will be in Ames at the Human Services Center, and then Friday will be over in Nevada at the Administration Building, which is the old courthouse downtown Nevada. Both days run 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., and you can contact me. I'll give my email again for an appointment, or give me a call, or call 1-800-RED-CROSS, which is 1-800-733-2767 to schedule an appointment. Opportunity to give back.
And it's not difficult to do that. It doesn't hurt. It's not difficult.
No, it's not. And about 30 minutes of your time can save half a dozen lives, possibly.
Yeah.
So my email again is lharder@storycountyiowa.gov.
Historically, has there been a good response when we had those?
Obviously, when we run around the same time, other ones that are nearby, like the one we had in spring, we do these two times a year. We've partnered with the Red Cross now for 4 years. We've had to really massage and manipulate our dates so that we're not competing with others within the area, because, again, there is a limited pool of people that are actually comfortable giving blood, and you have to space out the number of days. It's open to everyone. It's not just Story County employees. We have a large number of Story County employees that do it because
that's
it's
great.
Right there and convenient. But anyone from the public can give, and then next spring we'll do it again 2 days, and we've had good turnout.
Now, going back to the first item on your agenda, something about veterans. Could you talk about that again?
Well, we've got two things. The military, the Story County Military and Extension Conversations, that will be held next Friday, August 15th. That's next Wednesday, from 9 to 12. That's promoted by Iowa State Extension. So you, again, call 382-6551 by this Friday to register. And then the other thing I mentioned was the change in location of the Supermarket of Veterans Affairs, or Supermarket of Veterans Benefits. And that is scheduled for November 13th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Again, the new location is the Plex.
And they did that because the turnout is pretty large. Is that right?
Yeah, the turnout has been. You know, and what's really fascinating about this is we're not just capturing and gaining the attention of veterans in Story County. We're actually having veterans from surrounding counties come as well, which is wonderful. The service that they have given to our nation is there's not enough thanks we can give. So irregardless of where they reside, if they have an opportunity to come here on November 13th, they should take advantage of it.
You bet.
Leanne, we love having you here because you're not only informative, but you're also enthusiastic about what's happening. And what you mentioned today makes me proud to be a citizen of Story County, and very happy that your extension, your office, and all the things that you do to coordinate this really makes it work in Story County. So thank you again, Lee Ann Harder.
Thank you. I appreciate being able to come every
good
month.
Good to see you again.
Same here.
Purple Martins. No, I'm not talking about Dean Martin's family. Purple Martins. If you don't happen to be a Purple Martin landlord or never experienced a Purple Martin colony, you've missed out on some real joy you may want to catch up on. Walnut Woods, a park in the southwest corner of Polk County, has had some impressive work done to build a couple of Purple Martin colonies. KHOI naturalist reporter Pat Schlarbaum took a trip to Polk County and brought back this introduction to Tim Gedler, Walnut Woods Park Manager. Gedler is with the Department of Natural Resources, and he's a landlord to 40 nesting pairs of Purple Martins. Here's Pat.
Okay, we're here today with Tim Gedler, Park Manager, Department of Natural Resources, Walnut Woods. Tell us about your special setting here for Purple Martins. Tim Gedler.
Yeah, this area is located over in the southwest portion of Polk County, right near the intersection of Highway 5, the new bypass highway, and Interstate 35. This is an area that is now owned by the Des Moines Waterworks. They bought the old quarry here and is now under management by the DNR, meaning me at Walnut Woods. And this is an area I've birdwatched for many, many, many years, and Purple Martins were not part of this landscape, so I wanted to put up a Purple Martin house to bring Purple Martins back and have been successful thus far.
And the Purple Martin, I guess they're like a red-winged blackbird or the blackbird side. They're a swallow, maybe a bit larger than the barn swallows. Hopefully people can get an image of this dynamic soaring flight that we're enjoying here today. So Purple Martins like people.
They really do. People have been putting up Purple Martin houses since the early 1900s. The Native Americans, actually, around their villages were the first ones to figure out they could get Purple Martins to nest in structures made by hand. And they took natural gourds and would hollow them out and put them around their villages. And those were the first records of Purple Martins nesting in relation to people building houses for them. And
why do you suppose they did that?
Well, it's thought that one for the maybe the insects, but even more importantly, when you get a large colony of Purple Martins around a human village, for instance, with the Native Americans, anytime people would be sneaking up on their village, the Martins tend to go into quite a bit of chatter. So they think maybe it was like a way for the Native Americans to know when folks were creeping up on their villages.
What do they eat?
They are strictly aerial insectivores. They only eat flying insects, and so they become dependent on the weather temperatures. If it gets too cold, martins in the spring when they first get back to Iowa, actually after about 3 or 4 days of 50 degrees or less, start to starve to death. But yeah, they eat strictly flying insects. They don't go to the ground and eat bugs off the ground. They eat them in flight. They bathe in flight. They drink water while they're flying. They're made for the air.
Oh, fantastic. Where is it that they overwinter?
They fly clear down to South America. From Iowa here, it's over 5,000 miles to where they spend the winter.
Okay, I'm looking at some housing structures and quite a few Purple Martins. When did you start this colony?
I started 6 years ago putting the first house up. The first nesting martins didn't happen until 2 years later. I got my first two nesting pair 4 years ago. And now we're in the fourth year of nesting martins. So it went from two nests the first year. That following season we had 13 nests. And then the following season we jumped to 34 nests. And for this current season, we're up to 40-plus Purple Martin nests in those three houses.
I mean, that's just fantastic. I hope people can appreciate all the work that you've established here. I see some water in the background. I guess we got some quarries. We're associated with the Raccoon River. So what is it about water that you feel that these Purple Martins appreciate?
Well, it's just a great water source for the birds themselves. Martins do prefer to be near a body of water. It's more open. The martins are a bird of the open skies. They do not like trees. They'll nest within 60 feet of trees, especially if you have an established colony. The openness of the area where there's a pond or a lake is what attracts martins. They're more protected, less trees around for predators to prey on the colony, that being hawks and owls and so forth.
Well, let's see, what are we overlooking? This is really quite an operation that you've fashioned together here. And I see some bleachers and an interpretive panel. So this is kind of set up for the public to come and enjoy this.
It is. Most Purple Martin houses are put up in somebody's backyard, and they become kind of that person's, or that Purple Martin landlord, as they're called. It's their own little personal Martin colony. But the unique thing about a site like this is a public Purple Martin colony. If you've never experienced a large group of Purple Martins, I invite you to come to Purple Martin Lake and really take in the joy of these birds. Their flight is tremendous. They make a wide variety of chortles and whistles, and they're just a joy to watch, which is what lures people into putting all the work in to maintain a colony of Purple Martins.
And what is the work that you've got programmed here this morning?
At this time of the season, we're conducting regular nest checks on the houses. All the houses are on winches and cables. They can be raised and lowered at any time when we think there's problems. But we do regular nest checks on the house. About every 4 to 5 days, we lower the house down and check for parasites that get in the nest. We had that this weekend. One of the cavities in the house was just covered with these little mites in the nest. And so we actually will change the nest out in a cavity like that, take all the young out and put them in a bucket and cover it and treat that cavity with rubbing alcohol and take all the mite-infested nest out and replace it with fresh nesting material and place the young back in and raise the house up. And that way, we may have saved 6 young martins this year by doing that. If that house had been unmanaged, those young martins would have either jumped out of the house too early before they were ready to fly because of all the mites that were covering them, or they can actually kill the babies. So that's why we do these nest checks, to check for problems inside the nest, but it also helps us just overall to keep track of how many eggs are being laid and how many are hatching and so forth.
Is that data valuable? Is there organizations that you are associated with?
Yes, I work fairly closely with the Purple Martin Conservation Association. Martin landlords across the nation send in their reports to the Purple Martin Conservation Association. It really helps track how martins are doing overall across the United States where they nest.
How are the trends across the nation?
They're what we call locally uncommon because it's gotten to the point now where martins definitely are not threatened or endangered species, but really the only place you'll find them is where somebody has a colony of them started with a house up. They only nest in houses supplied by people. So the data that Purple Martin landlords are feeding into the Purple Martin Conservation Association are helping us with just migration trends, with climate change and weather events, hurricanes, and just overall migration. We've even done some banding of the Purple Martins here at Purple Martin Lake, and that is even further information that gets sent in that helps just track how these martins are doing on their annual migrations and so forth.
So it sounds like if the public could come by, I guess they'll spend their magic. And if they touch your heart, there are organizations out there, it sounds like, will include the websites in the archive of this program. So where are we at, Tim? And any closing remarks?
Again, just invite folks to come out here if you've never experienced the joys of watching Purple Martins and listening to Purple Martins, to find a house or a colony such as Purple Martin Lake.
Yeah, what exit off Highway 5?
It's exit 102 is what you take off of Highway 5, or exit 68 off of Interstate 35. And at that point, you're within 2 to 3 miles of this location. Yeah, and you can actually just do a Google search. I did not too long ago for Purple Martin Lake area, and it'll get you here.
Fantastic. Well, Tim Gedler, it's a hot day. We're going to go out here and do some work. Hopefully we can get some further recordings, but sounds like you've got a little piece of Iowa heaven right here at along the Raccoon River.
Yes. It's a public area, but I take ownership in this particular colony of martins. It's my interest to help them for every egg that hatches for a young martin to hit the skies. We are up to 54 young martins have already taken wing this season. We've had a total of 208 eggs laid in these 3 houses, and 168 of them have hatched, and things are going well for them this season.
This is KHOI 89.1 FM. You're listening to Tim Gedler, Department of Natural Resources Park Manager at Walnut Woods State Park, which is southwest of Des Moines on the Raccoon River. Tim is taking us into his Purple Martin area that he maintains, and lo and behold, a fish hawk or a fish eagle, an osprey, appears.
But it's sure nice to see ospreys flying with the Purple Martins.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the last couple seasons, it's been pretty neat during fledging time. I'll be just driving the roads now, and There will be martins, young martins, all lining on the utility wires, and that's something you wouldn't have seen around here about 15 years ago.
So it's quite a secure area. You got a beautiful Purple Martin interpretive panel here. I see that the Carolyn Sheldon Foundation provided the funding for this. Boy, it tells quite a story. And you're fencing. You've got a secure area. Site is nesting for Purple Martins, protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
Yeah, a big thanks to the Friends of Walnut Woods for this fenced enclosure around the Martin House to help deter vandalism is the main reason we put this out.
Right. It just kind of that somebody cares, and you do what you can. Boy, I think there's a second osprey now. Boy, I hope people can hear all this chittering going on. That is just so enlivening. Yeah. It's almost like a metallic twanging to a certain extent, isn't it?
Kind of the alarm call when you first walk into the enclosure. They do the little scream call. And
just then, to let you know, here's one with some flecking on its breast. Would this be a young of the year?
Or? Yeah, well, that's actually most likely a sub-adult male there. The purple martin, the typical dark purplish-bluish male purple martin doesn't reach that plumage for 2 years. The young males that are born this year and fly down to South America, when they come back next spring, they will look like that bird. They won't have their full purple yet.
Yeah, so. And I might mention that bird is on the porch of a makeshift gourd. I guess maybe a sense of territoriality and kind of fitting into this flock. And
it is.
It wouldn't be too big of a stretch to think someday that bird, if it survives, will come back.
Oh, yes.
It's got its spot located.
That particular nesting gourd there, all the young have fledged out of it for the season. So you're right. It could be that bird there could be. It's hard to tell the fledgling, the new fledged from those sub-adult males. But they do come back for about 2 weeks after fledging their compartment. They'll come back for the course of 2 weeks before they head south for the winter.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I sure hope they can pick up some of this sound. Yeah. Okay, so what can I help you with here? Hey, here's something I don't normally do, but it looks like you got a Purple Martin tattoo on your arm here. I generally don't ask people about their tattoos. Yes, so what's going on with that tattoo?
Well, the Purple Martin has become my favorite bird, and I felt compelled to permanently put that on my arm. So I have a nice tattoo of an adult Purple Martin on my left arm, and to help remind me of the joy these birds bring to the public and to myself.
And please include Psalm 84.
Psalm 84:3 talks about the swallow family. Even the swallow finds a nest near your altars, my Lord and my God.
I'm laughing. I'm chuckling. Okay, I think we're done here.
Yep, sounds good. All good.
Thank you, Tim Gedler. Gosh, what a great, great project that you have put together. I hope the people can appreciate all that you do for conservation. Tim Gedler, thank you.
Thank you, Pat, and thanks for your help along the way. You've helped me out here to get this started, and I'm appreciative. It's all a lot of everything's on the volunteer and grants, and that's what's made this area possible overall. But thank you.
You've been listening to Tim Gedler, park manager at Walnut Woods State Park, at his Purple Martin Lake with a colony of 40 nesting pairs of Purple Martins this year. With his Purple Martin tattoo that includes the biblical passage in Psalms 84:3.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and Local Talk was engineered today by Jackie Norman and by Aladdin, our new man here at the station. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard the song Iowa by Dar Williams.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. You can also hear a copy of this show on the homepage at khoifm.org later today. KHOI broadcasts at 89.1 FM and is heard online at khoifm.org, where you can also find an archive of our past shows.
Local Talk is a training workshop as well as a radio show, so please contact us if you would like to try your hand at reporting or engineering. We will train you and welcome you into the Local Talk team.
And remember to join us this coming Sunday from 4 to 7 o'clock in the afternoon for KHOI's birthday party. Bring a light-colored t-shirt and silkscreen the KHOI logo on it. Come ready to eat some good food and cake, to dance. Well, you and I can dance.
Yeah.
Or just enjoy the live music by the Heath Allen Band from Des Moines. That's what you're hearing underneath us here. The party's going to be right here at KHOI, 410 Douglas Avenue in Ames, and behind the station in the parking lot where the band will be performing. All free, and we just want you to come celebrate with us. Though if you feel moved to make a donation to support your community radio station, we'll be happy to take it. Again, that's Sunday 4 to 7 at KHOI, 410 Douglas, and behind the station in the parking lot. Paul, do you lead or do I lead if we dance together?
I don't know. I think I'll let you lead because I'm so recessive, you know.
I noticed that. Yeah, quite recessive. Yeah.
Well, now, please remember that your participation out there in the audience and your support as audience is what makes Local Talk and KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio. I think I'll lead.
KHOI is sponsored in part by Ames Electric Services, providing rebates to customers for upgrading to energy-efficient appliances, lighting, thermostats, and air conditioners. Smart energy rebates help you decrease your power needs, which can lower your electric bills. Learn more from www.cityofames.org/smartenergy.